from the North Carolina Reading Service, read for blind and print-impaired audience. Indie Week. It's Indie Week, read by John Feddersen. This week's issue dated August 26th of 2020. And we thank today's musical guests, the Little Orchestra That Could, and their conductor, Waddy Piper. And as they disappear around the track, they'll be back at the end of our broadcast. And we'll begin this week's issue with an op-ed called Keeping House, and it's written by two partners at HR&A Advisors. One of them a nationally recognized practitioner and thought leader on housing affordability. Right now, hundreds of thousands of our neighbors in Raleigh and throughout the state are facing eviction and homelessness during a pandemic. This crisis is not an inevitable consequence of COVID-19. It was created by a dual political failure, unemployment, and renter protections that perpetuate systemic racism and make moderate-income households vulnerable. North Carolina residents who have done nothing wrong, including families with children, will lose their homes and have to search for shelter if action is not taken. The state's unemployment system is built on the premise that minimal support for unemployed workers will provide an incentive to get them back to work. This approach fundamentally does not work if it is unsafe to work or if jobs are not available. On every measure, our state ranks behind national trends. Denial rates are high, payments are small, and benefits often expire after 12 weeks, which means workers laid off in April have already run out of benefits. Federal CARES Act funds provided supplemental income but expired at the end of July. This means that by this month, the majority of the 500,000 workers who lost their jobs this spring will have no income. The state's reopening has replaced some jobs, but limited reopening, caregiving needs, and a resurgent virus mean many are unable to return to work. Like many southern states, North Carolina has weak protections and limited access to legal services for tenants. Weak tenants' rights make it quick and inexpensive for landlords to evict. Prior to COVID-19, eviction rates in three of the state's cities were among the highest in the country, and the statewide eviction rate was almost double the national average. The governor's moratorium on evictions put in place at the beginning of the COVID-19 crisis kept families in their homes, but it expired on June 21st, which means households began to be evicted by late July. Between unemployment and exploitative eviction laws, hundreds and thousands of households and families will be forced from their homes, while the state's infection rates are at their highest level since the beginning of the pandemic. The pain this will inflict will be severe, yet not borne equally. Renters with an eviction record may face difficulty finding housing for years. Black and Hispanic households are both more likely to be renters and to have lost their jobs as a result of COVID-19. These groups will represent a disproportionate share of the households who will be forced from their homes. In the near term, rising homelessness will be a barrier to reaching stabilization for the state's health crisis and employment rates. It will overburden social services, stretch thin local budgets, and further challenge school districts. Landlords throughout the state will also lose as they face vacancy and must cut rent to attract households that are still employed. No one will be better off as a result of mass evictions. However, it doesn't have to be this way. There are many ways the state of North Carolina could solve this problem, but only one that does not depend on the state legislature. North Carolina could reform and improve its unemployment insurance system and provide households with months of additional assistance through this crisis. It could dedicate state funding to emergency rental assistance, to helping households make rent and mortgage payments as federal moratoriums expire. The obstacle is that each of these actions would require the legislature to act to protect working households. To avoid mass evictions and a widespread homelessness crisis, Governor Cooper must restate the eviction moratorium immediately. While it is in place, the governor and the legislature can work together to appropriate funding and address the impending homelessness crisis. Eventually, COVID-19 and the economic crisis it has sparked will pass. It will be important not to forget the lessons it teaches us. Unemployment is rarely a choice, and tenants rarely fail to pay their rent by choice. We all need programs that provide us with support if we fall upon hard times. Now we need to find a will to make those programs a reality. On to our news article. This one from Lee Taus from Raleigh. One misstep forward. Just after sundown on April 20th, 2019, a security guard stationed at a Sheetz gas station off New Bern Avenue called police to report a man trespassing who had already been asked to leave. The dispatcher on the call asked if the man had any weapons. The guard said no. At the same time, Officer William Brett Edwards just happened to pull into the plaza to refuel his patrol car. Minutes later, 8 bullets would rip through the body of Sohail Antonio Mogerad, a 30-year-old with a traumatic brain injury and a history of mental illness, killing him. Edwards claimed Mogerad had threatened him with a knife. A lawsuit from Mogerad's family alleges the knife was planted. He was never charged. Mogerad's death catalyzed calls for police accountability and reform, which, in the wake of nationwide Black Lives Matter protests, have morphed into calls to defund the agency and reallocate resources to community organizations that directly support those suffering from mental illness, homelessness, or addiction. The Raleigh Police Department, of course, wants to go in the exact opposite direction. Last week, Police Chief Cassandra Dick Brown unveiled a new program that ostensibly tries to rethink and reform policing the city's most vulnerable by throwing some social workers into the mix. Utilizing funds in the department's existing budget, the new Homelessness and Mental Health Unit would be comprised of 3 social workers, a detective, 3 officers, and a supervisor. When a call comes for a person suffering a mental health crisis, a social worker would tag along to aid with outreach and referrals. Dick Brown told the Raleigh City Council last week the unit would take a care and safety first, enforcement last approach. But activists aren't buying it. Dawn Blakegrove, executive director of Emancipate NC, says law enforcement has become the de facto mental health system, and that is in itself the problem. The way we fix that problem is not to give law enforcement more money to do a job they are ill-equipped to handle. According to data provided by RPD, officers responded to more than 6,500 calls dealing with mental health issues, substance abuse, and begging from July 2019 to June 2020. That breaks down to about 3 calls a day on average for someone suffering a mental health crisis. Another 3 calls on average each day deal with potential overdoses, and 3 more involve suicide threats. There's also the average of 4 calls a day where officers simply transfer paperwork from the magistrate to a hospital, a job an unarmed civilian could easily do. Just 4% of calls dealing with mental health crises were flagged as violent, yet 100% of the time an armed officer responds. Other cities have taken a different approach, including Cahoots in Eugene, Oregon, which for 3 decades has been sending a team of unarmed civilian medics and social workers as first responders to incidents involving mental health crises, substance abuse, or homeless individuals. In Denver, the newly created STAR program diverts certain low-level 911 calls to a similar unarmed team of social workers and paramedics. Councilmember David Cox wondered if Raleigh could consider such an approach. City Manager Ruffin Hall said it's not so simple. He said, "What we're trying here with the chief's approach is to leverage the resources we have to maximize the relationship with existing service providers. If we want to go with an independent or different unit, the first thing is it's going to cost a lot more money just in terms of a separate agency." We'll never know if having a social worker present could have made a difference in Mojarrad's situation. The officer's body-worn camera was shut off, and nearby security cameras failed to capture what led up to the shooting. Kerwin Pittman, a local advocate, doesn't trust the new unit will actually prioritize care. He says it will always be enforcement first, because the department's training involves first securing a scene before handing things over to adjacent agencies. He goes on, "We know law enforcement presence, with their military-style training and history, only exacerbates the problem these individuals are having once they see law enforcement. We're going to still see the same results when it comes to police brutality regarding those who are having crisis situations." Continuing on to our news column, Sarah Pequeño writes from Durham, "This is not okay. 21C's Instagram account is full of black art. The museum hotel chain, made up of 8 locations and 3 on the way, boasts rotating art exhibits. On Instagram, there are posts upon posts of black artist work, especially the work of black women. The captions mention black history, black childhood, and black culture. The first photo you see from the 21C Durham Hotel is from the reopening in July. Non-black faces greet the photographer at the front desk. A week later, they shared a simple graphic, a black background with white letters, saying, 'This is not okay.'" And the post caption reads, quote, "This week, we received reports of experiences which are not in keeping with our culture and are frankly difficult to hear. We immediately conducted an inquiry into the issues raised and have taken swift actions to address our findings." The caption doesn't mention the hotel where an incident occurs or even what the incident was, but commenters were quick to make the connection to a recent testimony out of Durham. On July 18th, former banquet captain Shakira Obery posted about her experiences with racism and misogyny at 21C Durham on Medium. The post, titled, "Ain't I Diversity? Inside Durham's Most Progressive Museum Hotel from a Black Woman," led other employees to speak of their experience at the downtown Durham location. "We reached out to 21C on Friday afternoon to clarify any incidents Obery and others have publicly posted about. We also asked about steps they were taking to change issues in the workplace." Sarah Robbins, chief operations officer at 21C, said in a statement mirroring the Instagram post, quote, "Though privacy issues limit our ability to discuss the details, we can share that we have received reports of experiences which are not in keeping with our culture and which are frankly difficult to hear. We immediately conducted an inquiry into the issues raised and have implemented corrective actions." The company also plans to have 30% minority lead leadership by 2023, according to a diversity and inclusion statement that was shared on Friday. Obery detailed experiences ranging from day-to-day microaggressions in the hotel kitchen to sexual harassment and racist comments from customers that were not handled by management. Obery told the Indy, white people think that racism is blatant, in your face, calling people the N-word. So if it doesn't look like that, it's really hard for them to pick up on those cues. She says she could sense annoyance from head chef Thomas Card and the kitchen staff whenever a black group would hold an event at the hotel. They made jokes about cooking up fried chicken or complaining they'd have to cook the food longer because of the stereotype that black people like their food well done. They would use black scents and mimic African-American vernacular when trying to speak with black employees. Obery also says the chefs, all white, would refer to black busboys or line cooks as boy. Another former high-ranking employee, who asked that we not use her name, says she also heard microaggressions from the kitchen staff, particularly from Chef Matt Bishop. When Bishop would make any Asian cuisine, she says he would call it ching chong sauce or ping pong soup. He also made comments about whenever she would crunch numbers, saying, "I thought Asians were supposed to be good at math." The hotel would not confirm whether Card or Bishop still work at 21C, although Obery said Card and one other chef were let go. But these weren't singular occurrences. The former employee says they happened constantly. Obery also detailed a few instances of sexual harassment in her post. Since sharing, other women have sent messages to the company about their experiences with sexual harassment. Black women had not received replies from human resources, Obery told the Indy, while non-black women had. Although she says this may be because the black women she spoke with were not current employees. She says other women received cookie-cutter apologies. Obery wrote in her post, "One thing I learned growing up as a black woman is that when there's racism, sexism is not too far behind." She described comments and gestures from the kitchen staff that made her uncomfortable, people touching her hair without permission, non-consensual touching and staring at her breasts while she was speaking to them. One employee asked her how big her nipples were. Another commented on a different server not wearing a bra. And in some instances, racism and sexual harassment overlapped. Obery detailed an incident that occurred when a company was holding multiple events at 21C over a week. She says a customer, who was the point of contact for several events that week, sexually harassed black male servers, excusing her behavior by mentioning that she was married to a black man. She kept trying to get them to dance with her. Linnea Johnson, Obery's former supervisor, went into further detail about that event with Indy. She says that during the incident, the woman put her arms around the waist of a server, asking him to dance with her because, quote, all black people know how to dance. Johnson said that later on, the woman told her that she didn't want to tip the black woman for working the event, but would tip the others. An anonymous former employee confirmed that the event happened, but said the company didn't address it at the request of the waiter. He also says at the end of the night, the woman left a tip that was then handed out equitably by management. When the entire incident was brought up to upper management, Johnson says she was told the banquet staff just needed to deal with it. Then the customer said she no longer wanted to work with Johnson, instead opting for her white assistant. Johnson, when speaking with Indy, says Obery's experiences were similar to hers. As event manager, one of her first experiences in the position was helping a black bride and groom plan their wedding. The couple had been through several managers who told Johnson that the clients were hard to work with. When Johnson met them, she says she realized they had been promised concessions for the inconvenience of being passed around. These concessions were not being given to them. When Johnson spoke with them on the phone, the marketing manager at the time grabbed it and yelled at them. One former male staff member, who asked not to be named, verified the incident to Indy, but also said the manager would likely do the same to other couples, too. When she was let go in 2019, Johnson posted on her Instagram account, detailing her experiences of racism within the company. She says human resources reached out to her once and asked for names, saying they would investigate. She says she never had a follow-up to this day. 21C is headquartered in Louisville, the hometown of Breonna Taylor, whose death at the hands of city police sparked Black Lives Matter protests in the area. In July, Change Today, Change Tomorrow, a Louisville nonprofit, said they would no longer be doing events at Garage Bar, the 21C Louisville restaurant. They shared on Facebook that the hotel's corporate managers refused to provide shelter for protesters and turned them away. A month before, the hotel posted a virtual memorial for Breonna Taylor and the Say Her Name movement called She Ascends. The caption reads, "Suddenly it appears, floating in space as a way to interact with and visit the memory of this moment, the fight for Breonna Taylor, black women, and community justice." Now, Tomasi McDonald contributes the cover story from this week's Indie Week, Portrait of a Black Revolutionary, The Incredible Journey of Activist and Socialist Vice Presidential Candidate Lamont Lilly, in our words, and his poems. Before running for vice president on the Workers' World Party ticket in 2016, Durham resident Lamont Lilly was a foot soldier in the thick of nearly every high-profile, racially charged protest in America. In 2011, the journalist, poet, and community organizer was in the middle of the Occupy Wall Street protests in New York. He joined the Workers' World Party that year. In 2014, he was marching, chanting, and taking to the highways during protests in Ferguson, Missouri, after Michael Brown Jr. was gunned down by the police. Lilly was one of the protesters who later encountered the heavily militarized police officer in riot gear, who tear-gassed the future vice presidential candidate and his fellow demonstrators. The world watched and repeated new phrases that have since entered the American protest lexicon. Hands up, don't shoot. And whose streets? Our streets. Lilly was angered, too, by the police murder of Eric Gardner in New York, where protesters gave voice to another cry, I can't breathe. And in 2015, he was in Baltimore for 3 months, organizing community forums, after Freddie Gray was found dead in the back of a police paddy wagon. I may have been a member of the Communist Party, but I was moving like any other black organizer, Lilly says. I didn't walk into meetings as a communist. I was just a black man trying to help get my people free. Lilly was at the CVS pharmacy in Baltimore that went up in flames after Gray's death, which he said marked a low point in how authorities confronted the protesters. Law officers took to the streets with tear gas tanks and militarized Humvees, along with drones and surveillance planes. Lilly says, we were standing in front of five tanks, dozens of assault rifles, and 50 police officers on horseback. We had tennis shoes, cardboard signs, bullhorns, and placards. Now, who came to riot, and who came for peace? He was also in Charleston in 2015 after white supremacist Dylann Roof shot and killed black worshippers at a historic church. 1 year later, he was reporting on the Dakota Access Pipeline protests by Sioux tribe members at the Standing Rock Indian Reservation in North Dakota. When George Floyd was murdered in Memorial Day, Lilly was with Bree Newsom, the Charlotte anti-racist who scaled a Confederate flagpole outside the South Carolina State House grounds. Lilly, a native of Fayetteville, is slim, with piercing liquid brown eyes. His is a purposeful gaze, framed by a long, deadlocked goatee that wisps at the end like the fine bristles of an artist's paintbrush. He grew up in a working-class home. His father was in the U.S. Army, and his mother was a certified nursing assistant who worked her way up to become a registered nurse. He says, my brother and I never missed a meal, but we also knew to take care of what we had because that was all we were going to get. Lilly moved to Durham in 1998 to study criminal justice at North Carolina Central University. He graduated in 2003 and never left a city he describes as beautiful. Fayetteville gave me, but Durham made me, he says. As an undergraduate, revolution and social change weren't even part of his thinking as far as what to do at the end of his studies. I wanted to be a lawyer. I was going to be one of those good little token Negroes for the system, says Lilly, who was also enlisted with the U.S. Army Reserve at the time. That was a different me back then, much different. The only kind of lawyer I would like to be now is Chokwe Lumumba, the attorney and former mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. Lilly was a college sophomore and working at a department store in Northgate Mall when he made a mistake that would affect him for the rest of his life. He caught a felony charge and conviction when he let a friend use his employee discount at the store. He was 19, alone in a room at the mall with a security guard who was questioning him. I was scared spitless, Lilly says. His upbringing and his parents' admonition to always admit wrongdoing led him to confess his crime to the black security guard who reported felony embezzlement charges for the $240 mistake. Lilly says, I didn't know that felony would follow me for the rest of my life. Musing over the good-paying jobs he's lost because of a criminal conviction now 2 decades old. He recalled at least 3 jobs in youth-oriented programs where less than a week after showing up for work, dressed in a suit, tie, and hard-bottom shoes, he was summarily fired. At one point, Lilly, who now shares a 2-bedroom apartment near NC Central with his partner and their daughter, was homeless. Now he's thankful for the experience. Had I never been homeless and struggling to eat, I wouldn't be able to properly relate to the homeless, he says. I can demystify myself and use those struggles to inspire others to do what I did. I need poor people and the formerly incarcerated to know it's possible to come out. Lilly readily identifies with the victims of America's massive prison industrial complex and the mass incarceration of black and brown people, the mockery loophole that informed filmmaker Ava DuVernay's documentary 13th. I'm still incarcerated here on the outside, he said. It's a third-class citizenship. The walls kept getting taller, even after a college degree. It was my first introduction to the criminal justice system. 2 years after graduating from NCCU, Lily was hired as director of the university's now-defunct African-American Male Leadership Academy, where he worked for 3 years with 80 families and young men considered at risk. After leaving the job in 2008, he waited tables part-time at Dame's Chicken and Waffles and at Cuban Revolution to make ends meet. He also worked seasonally at Measurement Incorporated. While a college student, Lily, like many of his student peers, often visited the now-closed The No bookstore several blocks away from the university. He was deeply influenced by the pan-Africanist teachings of history, culture, politics, and black pride by Bruce Bridges, the store owner. In 2015, Lily became a paid organizer with the Marxist-Leninist World Workers' Party. The party had been around since 1959, and Lily was impressed that the tenets of socialism were at the core of the Black Panther Party. He was paid $800 a month, with benefits that included one meal a day. Lily says, "The party leadership asked me would I like to organize full-time. It was a no-brainer. You going to pay me to be in the revolution? I'll take it. I was already doing this work for free for several years." Lily was a committed foot soldier. He was present at some of the nation's most volatile anti-racism protests, but he had also joined dozens of demonstrators here in Durham against the police-involved deaths of Jesus Huerta, Derek Walker, and Jesse Ocampo, along with Stephanie Nickerson, who was the victim of police excessive force, and Carlos Riley Jr., who was charged with shooting a police officer and later acquitted. In late 2015, party leaders asked Lily to be their vice presidential candidate. Lily never intended to run for political office and was hesitant. He said, "They told me, just keep being yourself." So he quietly made history with Monica Moorhead, his teacher and mentor, who is also black, at the top of the ticket. The candidates offered a 10-point platform that called for an end of the war on black people, reparations, an end to racism, the abolishment of capitalism, and an end to the mass incarceration of black and Latinx youths. The Moorhead-Lily ticket made 4 state ballots. Lily says, "We knew we weren't going to win. We used the campaign as a launching pad around anti-racism work, reparations, and colonialism." Lily is still a committed socialist, but he left the Workers' World Party in early 2018, soon after Durham activists, including fellow party members, pulled down the Confederate statue in front of the old courthouse on Main Street. Lily was not with the activists who knocked over the statue, but he led the support for them after their arrests and more demonstrations. Lily says a lot of people are not aware who brought it down. 5 out of the 8 arrestees were World Workers' Party members. We were not just activists. We were professional organizers. For decades, right-wing critics have tried to discredit protests and agitation for equality, including the civil rights movement, as attempts by the Communist Party to destabilize the government. That point is especially rich with the current White House resident's ongoing bromance with Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un. Lily brushes aside that criticism. "Terms like communist and left or right lose focus of the issues," he says. "The real question should be, is it just or not? Does it preserve lives and save the earth, or does it look to profit from it?" Durham sheriff's deputies ransacking the West Durham home he shared with 2 other party members while looking for the ladder used to tear down the statue was one thing. But Lily says the local party branch started fielding calls from all over the country from people who wanted to join their branch. Membership increased. Lily felt like the group was being targeted. The local party grew from a small, tight-knit, cohesive unit into a large organization where nerves were frayed because those who were arrested for the statue faced felony charges. He says, "Mix in a little ego, mix in pride, the bickering and infighting, it tears away at the cohesion." 3 months after the statue came down, Lily says he was sitting at a party meeting, wondering, "Who are these people?" "Knowing who is beside you is a matter of safety," he says. The same infiltration strategies happened to the Black Panther Party. The Black Lives Matter movement has recently come under attack by some members of the Republican Party, along with some black and white evangelicals who criticize it as godless and socialist. Lilly says labels can be distractions from the truth. The real question is, he says, are these laws just or unjust? Do they serve all people or just rich white men? It's a new season of activism for Lilly. In addition to working at an Indian restaurant in Chapel Hill, he writes for Truth Out, a nonprofit news organization. He mentors young people who visit his home and has increasingly turned to writing poetry to reach diverse audiences, particularly young people. Lilly's pretty sure the FBI has compiled a file on his activist activities and that he's, quote, no longer under the radar. He chooses his words carefully. He says, at this point, what's most important is sharing this history and these experiences with the next generation. If we don't teach them the truth, they'll think that the police kneeling at protests or painting big block letters in the street equals progress. The revolutionaries of today have to teach the revolutionaries of tomorrow. If we don't, there won't be any more revolutionaries. This article includes three poems by Mr. Lilly, and I will read in my own non-competent way two of them. One is called 41 Times. Shot in the head, shot in the back, shot 41 times while laying on the ground. There were 13 officers who shot that man down. 13 officers who turned around and accused him of shooting himself dead, of shooting himself in the head with handcuffs on 41 times. That's the fourth black man they've shot in the head. That's the fourth black man dead this month. And the other poem, at least we ate. We ate the week-old bread, plain, and we're thankful for that. No peanut butter and strawberry jam, no mayonnaise and fried bologna, no honey, no syrup, no grandma's country molasses. We ate the week-old bread, plain, and we're thankful for that. Remembering how just last month there was nothing at all, no bread, no spreads, no nothing, nothing at all. Well, Layla Curry Hanold writes the food column this week, one of them, for Indie Week, and this is called Comfort Zone. When should we go out to eat? Remember, the hardest part of answering that question was choosing a restaurant that would satisfy everyone. Now, amid a global pandemic in which fear, anxiety, and uncertainty rule, the guiding principle is safety. The new question is, where do we feel comfortable going out to eat? With a city and county-supported initiative called Back on the Bull, Durham businesses, including restaurants, can complete a free and voluntary online certification that provides industry-specific health and safety checklists. Diners can search the online database of participating restaurants and see which measures they're implementing, then make an informed decision about where they'll be safest. Now, Marielle Beasley, principal at the Center for Advanced Hindsight at Duke University, which was tapped by the Durham Recovery and Renewal Task Force to incorporate behavioral science research into the planning tools, says, the goal is to make it safe as possible for staff and visitors, to increase the understanding of the value businesses are bringing to the community, and to inspire additional support. Now, this Recovery and Renewal Task Force is a group of 15 community members, including public health experts, business leaders, and community and faith leaders, who are appointed to advise Mayor Steve Shule and Commissioner Chair Wendy Jacobs as Durham reopens. Beasley praises existing programs such as Count on Me NC, a voluntary certification created by the North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association that offers hospitality businesses public health-backed guidelines for protecting consumers. But Back on the Bull's behavioral science lens adds another dimension to engendering consumer confidence. Beasley says we wanted to peel back the layer a bit and make visible the invisible. That transparency is such an important piece to that confidence. Transparency is key because it helps address risk and probability, concepts that Beasley says human beings don't understand well, especially with unknown factors such as COVID-19. She explains, people understand that there are risky things going on, but they don't understand the risk levels. But providing some sort of transparent view into looking at all the things people are doing can help people who are extra cautious to make better judgments and feel safer. Beasley also says humans have limited attention spans and tend to be egocentric. Thus, we only think of and value what we can easily see in front of us. To that end, Back in the Bull tapped McKinney, a Durham-based creative agency, to develop branding, posters, and social media assets in English and Spanish to visually convey the procedures businesses are implementing. McKinney also designed Back on the Bull's website called backonthebull.com, which includes the planning and certification tool and printable PDFs for each business's checklist. Before venturing out, consumers can search an online database of all participating businesses, which can be filtered by parameters such as Black, female, Hispanic, Latinx, LGBTQ, or other minority-owned businesses. Clicking on a business shows the top 5 health and safety measures it has committed to, as well as an option to view the complete list. The top 5 for Durham Food Hall, an early adopter of Back on the Bull, includes requiring employees to wear a clean mask each day, removing tables and chairs, arranging them at least 6 feet apart, screening staff daily in their native language for common COVID-19 symptoms, disinfecting the surfaces of frequently touched objects at least once per hour, and posting the CDC guidelines for staff. Back on the Bull checklists and campaign posters are also prominently displayed on the food hall's entryway windows and inside the space. The transparency in making this information public not only helps to inspire trust among consumers, but also serves as an added commitment device for business owners. Beasley says, devices are helpful to follow through on intentions. They give us accountability. When restaurants are publicly posting commitments, they're outsourcing that additional accountability, and they're more likely to follow through on their intentions. Posting checklists that clearly outline a business's health and safety measures can also help employees feel safer coming to work. It also helps to convey the added value that participating businesses are bringing to the community. Adair Mueller, Durham's Food Hall's founder, says, through joining the Back on the Bull campaign and making our dedication to COVID safety front and center, our staff feels a sense of encouragement from the positive reactions we receive from guests. This is extremely rewarding right now when we're putting so much time and effort into it. Restaurant owners have also had to redefine hospitality with public health and staff safety in mind. Some of Back on the Bull's recommendations for dine-in service include minimizing table visits by having servers clear the table once everyone has finished. To reduce time spent tableside, servers are encouraged to place all food at the front of the table for guests to distribute themselves. To reduce contaminated surfaces, disposable plates and utensils are recommended. Single-use condiments replace condiment caddies. Implementing and communicating these additional safety measures comes at an added monetary and mental health cost for restaurateurs, something that the average diner probably won't have thought about pre-pandemic. Hopefully, this transparency will help illuminate what it takes to operate a restaurant and the value of its workforce. Perhaps in the future, diners will ask, where should we eat where we know the staff will feel as comfortable as us? All right, let's get to a couple at least, music takes. This one called Her Take, written by Keisha Jennings. Sound Pro. We visit the studio of Brian Kidd. Brian, thank you so much for making this sound so good. You are a legend. Be safe out there. This note, written on a post-it, was penned by Sax Kicks Av, a New Orleans duo made up of Alfred Banks and Albert Allenback of Tank and the Bangas. It was attached to a vinyl copy of their debut EP, I Don't Wear Suits, and placed neatly on the futon in Brian Kidd's home studio. Kidd, a Raleigh-based music engineer, has established himself as the go-to person for mixing and mastering needs in the Triangle over the past 4 years. He has worked on projects Pat Jr., The Deep End, Nance, De Facto Thespian, Les the Genius, Sky Blue, Millie Vaughn, Kelly Kale, and Tab One, just to name a few. He's also mixed and mastered more than 10 albums that have reached the iTunes charts. Five of them were in the top five hip-hop charts, and three projects charted on Billboard, Eshan Burgundy's For the Love of Money, Call Me Ace's Airplane Mode, and Alfred Banks' The Beautiful. I recently visited Kidd's home studio, which he says was inspired by Common and the late J. Dilla's basement studio when the two were roommates. On walking in, I was immediately impressed by the professional setup. I was curious about how each machine operated, which switches controlled what. Most of the gear is for engineering, but there's also a Machine Studio DAW, or Digital Audio Workstation, that's more for producing original music than for perfecting existing music. Kidd says, probably about to get back into production. I haven't produced in like 10 years. Originally from Hampton, Virginia, Kidd grew up as the son of a pastor and a choir director. His interest in music was first sparked by his upbringing in the church. He says, because of my parents, music was all throughout the house, so definitely that's what sparked the bug in me. What it evolved into me thinking where I wanted to go with it was when I heard Little Brother's first album, The Listening. I was like, I got to do something in music. His affinity for Little Brother led him to major in audio recording technology and to get out of Virginia. He says, I was looking at North Carolina Central, Elizabeth City, Barton College, and Old Dominion University. I crossed out ODU, he says, because I didn't want to be home. It's right down the street. After comparing the three North Carolina colleges, he landed on Barton. From the start, he had his parents' full support. They took him to tour the college and were impressed by the professors and the school's recording studio. While Kidd was in school, his dad, a school teacher who knew a lot of people on the scene and at the school, connected him with a local musician who offered a summer internship. Kidd says, there was a guy named Martin Bloxon. He was a saxophonist, jazz player, recording engineer, just an all-around dope musician from Hampton. He went to Berklee College of Music, and he also worked with Lena Hathaway and other prominent jazz folks. He showed me the ins and outs of recording. I would just sit and watch for hours. After graduating, Kidd put together a plan that, in retrospect, was genius. Upon realizing that most artists included their emails on their Twitter bios, he emailed all of his favorite artists, requesting to work with them. I always tell people, thank God for Kay Hill, Kidd says. I didn't know him at all. I just knew of his music, and he was one of my favorite rappers. He hit me back and took me under his wing. He was like, hey, man, anything I got, you got. Kay Hill's mentorship afforded Kidd the experience he needed as an emerging audio engineer. Kay Hill had a production deal with the label Neblina Records and passed on Kidd's name. At the time, Kidd says, I was doing stuff for free to get my name out, and Kay Hill was like, I must see if I can get you paid by the label. I always thanked Kay Hill for that. That connection led to many others, and now Kidd has worked with artists all over the world, from North Carolina to New Orleans, Los Angeles, Texas, South Africa, and Australia. Over the past few years, Kidd's ability to network and seek out opportunities has proven to be his biggest strength. An email he sent to Nashville MC D. Goods paid off years after he sent it, when the rapper finally reached out. I had hit them up prior, but in 2015 he was like, yo, B. Kidd, I got this project. It's about done. You down to mix it? I'm like, yeah, of course, Kidd says. Grammy-winning producer Chase N. Cash, whose prior credits include Drake, Beyoncé, the Pussycat Dolls, and J. Cole, produced D. Goods' project. Kids' work and work ethic impressed Cash, and the two began to build their own relationship, which has now gone on for 5 years. In 2016, Kid relocated from Wilson to the Triangle. Prior to moving, he would rent a car for one day, knowing his unreliable car could not make the hour-long drive, just to network at local music shows and events. Now, during the day, Kid works as a service specialist for the city of Raleigh, but with his increased success, music has become his primary source of income. His knowledge of music and sound, coupled with his ability to build and sustain relationships, has led him to become North Carolina's engineer extraordinaire. Next in line, Will Atkinson writes Boss Music. The concept of a video galbum, as electropop trio Body Games cheekily describes its newest release, is an obvious attention grabber. But absurd side quests and copious references to marijuana aside, Super Body Games RPG is more than a fun gimmick. The game, which will be available to download on the band's website August 27th, is impressively detailed passion project and a love letter to the town that made Body Games and so many bands like it. The downtown Carborough featured in Super Body Games RPG will be recognizable to anyone who has spent time on the Main Street corridor. The game's main character, a genderless alien sent to Earth on a mission to defend the planet from vaguely defined evil, arrives on the railroad crossing next to Cat's Cradle. Down the street are recreations of the Orange County Social Club, Jade Palace, and Wendy's. One block over, you'll find the tables and benches outside Weaver Street Market. Along with these three local landmarks, the gameplay is stuffed with in-jokes and homages to the Triangle music scene, a radio tuned to 88.1 FM, a remix of Al Riggs as the town's soundtrack, and an abandoned screenplay at All Day Records. Even the indie makes a cameo. As the game progresses, though, it becomes clear that something more sinister looks behind those familiar storefronts. A concert at the Cradle by Eurodance one-hit wonders Eiffel 65, underway as the game starts, seems to have the town in a weird mood. Something important may be hidden underneath Jade Palace, too, and the Carborough Century Center contains a few dark secrets. Between the web of absurd adventures, one particularly bizarre side quest revolves around the actor Jonah Hill. The game's full soundtrack and the Super Body Games EP become available through download codes, unlocked as a player works through the game. Coming 4 years after Body Games' full-length debut, Damager, three of the four tracks on the new EP have long been staples of their live set. In contrast with the suitably bite-sized demos and remixes of the game's soundtrack, the songs on Super Body Games EP are big, all shimmering nostalgia and widescreen emotion. The record will eventually be released on its own, but in the meantime, it is a satisfying reward for those persistent enough to finish the quest. It's become a cliché to read our collective quarantine into all the art released during the coronavirus pandemic. Certainly, it's tempted to feel that way about a six-hour single-player experience that seems almost tailor-made for being home alone. But anyone who has followed Body Games knows the long-rumored video galbum goes back much further. As the band tells it, in 2014, they were near a point of creative exhaustion. Deep into the production of what would become Damager in 2016, and fresh off an electrifying hopscotch set, producer Dax Beaton, vocalist and keyboardist Kate Thompson, and visual artist Adam Graetz longed for a break from the taxing process of writing and recording a full-length album. An idea arose. Beaton recalls thinking, what if we could just write music for video games or something? We kind of talked about it as a joke. Yet the idea of making a retro game wasn't that far-fetched for Body Games, whose electro-pop is contemporary, but whose sensibility is drenched with 90s nostalgia. Graetz, who also makes video art as The Faces Blur, drenches their live shows in vaporware projections. Their cover of Colors of the Wind from Disney's Pocahontas is a staple. Super Body Games RPG looks like it could have appeared on the Super Nintendo 30 years ago and was specifically inspired by computer adventure games like King's Quest and Commander Keen. Thompson says, people said that we made songs that sound like video game music, noting that the previous releases frequently sampled video games. Super Body Games EP includes a different video game sample on each of its four tracks, such as 1997 PlayStation hit Parappa the Rapper on Night Magic. Thompson, Beaton, and Gritz batted the idea around, debating which friends they would cast as heroes and which awful sound guy would be the arch nemesis. And after the release of Damager, what began as a joke soon became the group's next big project. With the help of a friend, Derek Goode, formerly of Carburo's The Worms, Beaton conceived of the basic storyline and reconstructed Carburo using a software called RPG Maker, MPMV, visiting the local businesses featured in the game to make sure that interior details, like the number of booths or the position of tables in a restaurant, matched closely with reality. Although Beaton had designed small RPGs before, neither he nor Goode had formal experience developing a game of this scale, which would normally involve an entire team of collaborators. Goode says, pretty quickly it was obvious that it was going to be way harder to flesh out and not make it a big mess. We both were in way over our heads. Still, progress on the game kept moving. In July 2018, the band announced that Super Body Games RPG would arrive later that year, but by then, Goode had moved to Wilmington, and Beaton was single-handedly writing, developing, and refining the game. Beaton says, I just thought, I've got to get this out. I've got to do it. I felt like I wouldn't allow myself to do anything creatively until this game was done. Paralyzed by perfectionism, overwhelmed by the amount of feedback the beta test received, Beaton hit a wall for a while. Super Body Games got stuck at almost done. And then, of course, 2020 happened, as the band was gearing up for a string of never-to-be live sets in the spring. Thompson says, we had just started playing again and reacquainting ourselves with our live show and what we really wanted to do. Like, yeah, we've really got something big going now. But with the loss of shows also came more time for Super Body Games RPG. They knew that if the game was ever going to be finished, this was the time. With so many people facing financial hardship, the band ultimately decided to release the game free of charge. They're coordinating with some of the businesses in the game, including OCSC, Cat's Cradle, and All Day Records, to allow players to make a suggested donation to the fundraiser of their choice when they download. The members of Body Games are now scattered throughout the triangle. Beaton is still in Carburo, Thompson is in Raleigh, and Gritz is in Durham. But Super Body Games is very much a Carburo game, paying tribute to the place where the band put down its roots. Beaton says, all of the stops in the game are places where we hung out and grew up together in terms of Body Games, the life of a band. So it very much fits to try to give back in some way to this goofy-ass, wonderful town we live in. Playing the game, it's oddly comforting to roam through the streets of Carburo, even if only virtually, with so many of its doors closed in the real world, or at the very least limited to the public. The game is an ode to the town's enduring character and a reminder of better times. There may not be shows at the Cradle for the time being, but in Super Body Games RPG, Carburo is still open for business. Finally, if I have time to read this article by George Jin, The Arts, Truth to Power. Speak Truth to Power is the title of a 1955 Quaker pamphlet that pushed against America's commitment to violence as an international doctrine. It continued to reflect America's struggles in 2013 when Durham's Pleiades Arts, then a physical gallery, now a community arts organization, adopted the pamphlet's spirit and title for its first annual group exhibit, addressing matters of social justice. This month, in its 8th incarnation, Truth to Power launched into a perfect storm when structural racism dominated the conversation and a relentless pandemic forced us to experience art without ever setting foot in a gallery. This is to say that, culturally, it couldn't be a better time for an activist exhibit meant to bring people together in dialogue with the art and one another. But practically, it couldn't be worse. The show is housed at Power Plant Gallery, an arm of Duke's Experimental and Documentary Arts Master of Fine Arts program. It's bound to Duke's COVID-19 response guidelines, which require the space to remain closed for the foreseeable future. In lieu of wandering the gallery, you can walk through an online catalog of the show. Pleiades does its level best to translate the power of each work from the gallery into the digital realm. Each artist gets a 2-page spread that displays their work, along with text and a supplementary video link. For anyone immersed in contemporary art, it's a given that a JPEG on a computer screen pales in comparison to the real thing. So the online format is apt in that it feeds a frustration that is inherent to this sudden, necessary withholding of cultural experiences. Keep in mind that we are witnessing a pioneering moment when galleries and art institutions are inventing new exhibition strategies as they wade through the pandemic. They're probing new digital territory, so they will remain financially sound and continue to provide for their artists and patrons, regardless of physical space. No one could claim that this is the ideal medium for, say, large-scale paintings, but if you take your time exploring the catalog, the effort pays dividends. Jurors Angel Dozier and Cornelio Campos selected 30 artists who represent a buoying swath of personalities and experiences. The texture of the show is satiating in its breadth, while each selection is steadfastly anchored to the common cause. The pieces that stand out transcend the digital format by playing directly to its strength. Rox Campbell's Color Bar, American South. It is at home on the computer screen. An oil painting by Bethany Bash, titled Self-Portrait as Amy Cooper, spins us into an entirely different perspective on racism. I've had to drastically cut this article, but it closes. It's entirely possible that there are even better works in the show that shine best on the walls of Power Plant's physical space, but only when we walk through the gallery, stand inches from the art, rest our heads from one side, and soak it all in, will we know. For now, for the sake of the artists and for the sake of the cause that Truth to Power represents, we can embrace one of the early attempts at bringing an overtly political exhibition to view, when a multitude of forces, natural, social, and political, seem dead set on repression. So, we have to close quickly, and we will have this broadcast available on a podcast at ncreadingservice.org for the whole next week, and we will see you next week.